Yes, we should be started now.
Okay, this is Sarah Sheard. I'd like to introduce David Ng, President-elect of the International Society for System Sciences, and he'll be talking today about the relationship of system sciences to systems engineering. So go ahead, David.
Thanks. I see that I'm recording. It says I'm recording, but I don't see the counter changing. So we'll see if anyone actually gets a version of this afterwards.
That's interesting. Let's stop it and start it again. It should...
Okay, stop.
Okay.
No, let's say, actually, say continue recording. I'll just say continue.
Okay.
We'll assume that that's working.
Okay.
So thanks, Sarah. It was interesting to be asked to give a talk on system sciences because that's like someone in your organization just being asked to give a talk on systems engineering and what is it. So it's a very large field. I've been provoked by questions. Jack Ring had sent a back channel email that he wondered, said he was going to protest because it's systems in plural and sciences in plural, and there's reasons for that, as I'll get down to explaining it a little bit. So I have these slides available on the web. This is done in a visual map that you can go and see, and I'll eventually be surfacing it on my blog so other people can see it as well. Just to give you an idea of where I'm at, if people are wondering who I am, you can actually look me up on Wikipedia. It's not something I put there. It's something they gleaned from across the web. I have three roles. Firstly, as Sarah had said, President-elect of the International Society for the System Sciences, which I'll talk about a little bit. I have a second role where I'm a visiting scholar at Aalto University in Finland, and my day job is at IBM. So that gets plugged into everything else. I'm also blogging a lot at coevolving.com. If you click through on these web pages, you end up seeing those sorts of things where I'm blogging. So I'm fairly visible. People are looking for me. So what I thought I would do is give a talk on two things. Firstly, a perspective from outside the systems engineering community. And so this is a little bit of how I see the system sciences, and it's a large domain where I think there's a lot of different people working on it. Later on, I'll scroll down and give you the perspective from inside the systems engineering community because I found an interesting article that was written some years ago by John Warfield, and it creates an interesting discussion about how he saw system sciences from the systems engineering viewpoint. So let me start off with this talk at the top. I'm going to talk about the systems movement as a system of ideas. And this is one of the interesting things about talking about systems and the concepts of systems is that if you try to retreat to the definitions of an individual, to say what is a system, what is a function, what is structure, these sorts of things, you very rapidly get into trying to reconcile different people giving different definitions. And so the way that I generally look at systems is much more as a system of ideas around an individual or around a group of people who share similar sorts of ideas. And then you get, of course, all the frictions from all the people who think similarly and think differently. But the first part I'm going to talk about is systems community as individuals, organizations, and publications. And the reason for doing that is these are the places where the systems people bind together. So I'll get into a more content-related discussion in the section below. But for now, if I talk about organizations, I'm a member of the International Society for the System Sciences. I'm president-elect. The current president is Jennifer Wilby, who is at the University of Hull in the UK. We've been active for over 50 years as an organization. The first president was Margaret Mead, so it creates a lot of interesting shoes to fill along the way. In previous discussions, we've also had Gary Metcalf, who is president for the International Federation for Systems Research. And what I want to point out, and people get confused about these roles, is that the ISSS is an organization of individuals. And so I'm a member, you're a member, you could join. The International Federation of Systems Research is an organization of organizations. And so the ISSF is a member of the International Federation for Systems Research. What that means is there's these interesting interlocking relationships. In particular, if you talk about the journal, which is Systems Research and Behavioral Science, that is actually a journal of the IFSR, and it's the leading journal for the domain. It was actually two journals originally. Systems Research was one journal, and Behavioral Science was a second journal, and the two merged more than a decade ago. One of the interesting wrinkles that comes along is that the ISSF publishes the General Systems Yearbook into the Systems Research and Behavioral Science, which is one volume a year. And so we have that interesting relationship. So if you're looking for journals that describe what's happening in the system sciences, Systems Research and Behavioral Science is available at most academic libraries. There's other organizations within the IFSR, including the American Society for Cybernetics. There's a difference between the cybernetics people and the objective theory people. So the ISSS has tended to be more of the people that take a biological approach, following von Bertalanffy and working with those ideas. The people that are working in the cybernetics approach come down from a different vein, and so you end up with people like Ross Ashby and Safford Beer and people in those communities. And so between the two of them, we actually get a lot of mixing back and forth, but you'll find that there's a predisposition towards one or the other, and people generally work back and forth between them. So we have ASC members that come to the ISSS meetings. We have ISSS members that come to the ASC meetings. Within IFSR, because it's an international organization and it's organized historically out of Austria, there's a number of other organizations. Australia, New Zealand has an active chapter that does the ANSYS System Society. This is one in Japan, China, Slovenia, Greece. If you go to the IFSR website, you'll see they have a list. And it's been interesting working with the IFSR because in less developed countries, they're less interested in the individuals and more interested in the groups because they tend to need institutions. And so as an example, Gary Metcalf was recently in China where they've been working on system science and systems engineering and having the organization as an institution helps a lot there. Just talk about some of the other organizations that are in around the systems movement that aren't part of the IFSR and ISSS. We have the UK System Society, which runs a conference every September at Oxford. That's been the history. It's not associated with the IFSR right now. They had also, there's a journal out of the UK called Systemic Practice and Action Research. And this is more practitioner-oriented, whereas the Systems Research and Behavioral Science Journal is more academic. The Systems Dynamics Society co-sponsors some of the ISSS events, so we coordinate with them. They publish Systems Dynamics Review. We have some members who are part of the Resilience Alliance, and they publish in an online journal called Ecology and Society that you can see online. So when we talk about the system sciences, we've got this broad range, and we come just going across the bottom here, ISSS with a history in von Bertalanffy, but 50 years of a lot of figures, Wes Churchman, Russell Acuff, Len Troncalli, who has visited recently. A lot of these people have been associated with the society. ASC, who's more into the cybernetics approach. UK System Society, which has UK has a rich body of research, and so you see people like Peter Checkland and soft systems methodologies working in there. Systems Dynamics, long-term association with the people at MIT, and Resilience Alliance, which is a lot of ecologists and people who are focused more in biology. So that's the people associated with system sciences, and that's why when we use the word systems, we could be multiple systems we're looking at, and we use sciences, it'd be hard to make these all one science, and so that's why it's phrased the way it is. if we don't have any immediate questions, I'll go on to the next section, which is to describe a paper that I had written. I just found out that it's going to be it's been submitted into a book that's coming out in February, and we just finally got the ISBN number, so that's been interesting. But what I wanted to talk about was 10 frames to guide thinking and discussions about changes in society, economics, and technology in the 21st century. One of the emphases that I have as a personal research interest is on services, science, management, engineering, and design. And this is, in effect, systems in the service economy that we have today. And so this was started as an initiative from IBM Research. Jim Spohr had first given a talk at the ISSS in 2005. And so now we're into 5 years of a 10-year research agenda, as Jim had said. We're still working through a lot of the foundations. But one of the things that Jim Spohr has said is that if we're looking at the service economy and we are looking at service systems, the foundations for service science are in the system sciences. One of the reasons I get attracted to the system sciences is if you define the systems correctly, the definitions work very generally across human systems, across technical systems, across economies, across ecologies. And so in thinking about these, what I did was I had the challenge at one of the IFSS meetings, the Fuchel conversation that was 2 years ago. We had a conversation about what were the basic ideas of systems. And so I came up with this list of 10, arbitrary 10, but it stuck and it gotten published now. So I'm going to talk about these because when we talk about systems at depth, the question that everyone asks is what is a system and, you know, how do we use it and all that sort of stuff. I'd like to back off a little bit and suggest that there's multiple ways of looking at systems and that we might consider using those different frames in different ways. This is framed in terms of service systems, but as I've described, it probably generalizes into most systems. Most systems that can be designed by human beings anyway. Sorry. Let me close that window. Go back to what happened here. Okay, here we are. Okay, so the first of the frames that we can look at are business models and value creations. And this is a question about why do we care about service systems. There's been a lot of written about the service economy and how we understand or don't understand it. Sometimes it's called the information economy, sometimes it's called a knowledge economy, sometimes it's called globalization, but all these sorts of things all come up together. And so each of those get mixed up in a big tangle. Some of the researchers that I find that are helpful here are Richard Norman, who passed away, Rafael Ramirez, who's at Oxford, Johan Wallin, who is in Finland. But they had done a lot of work on value constellations, on value creation. And from a systems perspective, when we're looking at the definitions, the interesting part of those definitions is that they stand up in all sorts of systems. They understand human systems. They understand the idea of constraints. So as an example, one of the things that Norman and Ramirez had written about was about technology. And what they said that technology removes constraints. So something that was a constraint in the world before that you couldn't do but would create value now is doable, it's feasible because you have new technology. And so I found them very helpful in getting down to questions of value and value creation and why systems exist. The second topic on ignorance and knowledge asks the questions about what's known, knowable, and unknowable. I've been teaching recently in Finland. I've been blogging about that teaching. And one of the things that, that's been struck in that course and makes students think pretty hard is how can you design for the unknown unknowns? We have this idea of what's called post-normal science, where you can't know what's in the future. If you can't know, then how is it you design? And so there's interesting research. Witte and Kerwin are at the College of Medical Ignorance in Arizona, and they created a large body of work, and they're the ones that they teach doctors that medicine doesn't have all the answers. So what do you do when you don't have all the answers? And you have to be a little bit humble about that. We also get into Churchman's The Design of Inquiring Systems. How do you design a system that, in effect, learns? And the learns is an interesting description. The Bateson definition of learning means that you're able to respond to the environment and change and respond to the environment. So it's not just a pedagogical sort of thing. But when you talk about learning in the Bateson sense, there's another book by Stuart Brand called How Buildings Learn. And you ask the question, how could a building learn? Well, a building is adapted to the environment over time, so you could say that the building learns. And that comes from a deeper understanding of what learning means in the system context. The third topic, a boundary. Where do we draw the lines delimiting service systems from their environments? When we talk about systems, boundary is such a basic concept, and it turns out that a lot of the issues we come into are about where the boundary is. In technologies, we always have this question about whether the human being is in the system or outside the system, and what happens when you put the person inside the system. Werner Ulrich was one of Wes Churchman's students, and has done work on what's called boundary critique. And in effect, that is the issue about how it is that the issues that arise if you draw the boundary in the wrong way. So how do you define a system? When you start talking about where you draw a boundary, then it starts getting into how you define the system, which influences the way you may or may not intervene in that system. So that takes a while to get used to that. One of the articles I use in describing systems is by Russell Acuff, who talks about system thinking. And systems thinking, you start with the containing whole as opposed to going into the system and being reductive and going into its parts. And so it's always interesting when you start taking that exercise because you get into, well, what is the system to be designed, and then what is the containing system? And quite often it's more difficult to describe the containing system than it is to describe the system you want to design. But if you want to make real change, you make it in the containing system, and then the system in which you're designing is changed by that. Fourth topic, on order, purpose, and self-organization. If we get into the system now and we have this case, as I said, number two, that you can't necessarily design everything, then what parts of the system should you design on purpose, and which parts should you let have an emergent function? So we need a little clarity here on emergence. Let me describe my simple definition of emergence, which is, no matter how much you study the properties of hydrogen and oxygen, you're not going to learn much about the wetness of water from any of those parts. Wetness is an emergent property from hydrogen and oxygen. Wetness is a property which is in the whole, which is water. So if that's the case, then if you were trying to design things at the hydrogen-oxygen level and trying to make something wetter, you're not going to be very successful. And you actually need to design for that emergence. Emergence is a tricky thing because people think that means unpredictability. It doesn't necessarily mean unpredictability. It just means that you've defined a different level of system at which you would like some properties to happen. The sort of people that do research in this area, Emery and Trist had done a work on turbulent environments. So what happens when the environment changes so quickly that you can't respond? And how do you handle and design for that? Anselm Strauss had done work originally, foundational, about emergency rooms and how people work in emergency rooms. That influenced some of the work by David Hawk. Steve Heckel in Adaptive Enterprise had done work around this sort of thing, and Russ Acuff has done lots of work around the ideas of order and purpose. So this is a large body of work. Actually, when I look at the work that John Warfield was interested in, I see a lot of the spirit focused on this part. But the challenge you get into is if you have all these other frames to think about things, you can't just focus on the order and purpose. So as an example, if you are trying to define an end, and I'll lean on Russ Acoff's definition. So Russ has three time horizons. The first is I'll start off with an ideal that is not achievable in any period. You have a goal, which is the shortest one, which is achievable within a period planned. And then in the middle, you've got objectives, which are not achievable within the period planned, but achievable in a longer period. So we could have, as an example, a one-year plan that has a five-year objective. And then you have the ideal, which would be something that you can't do, possibly because the technology is constrained at this point. So that you can't do it today, but, you know, 10 years from now, maybe you could do it with a new technology. So you can have that sort of discussion about ends, but then you get rapidly into the issue of ignorance and knowledge because you can't predict the future, so how is it you could actually work with that? And you get into the question of whether things are knowable or not knowable. If you're lucky, you'll be in a case where some individual within a population or a group may know, and then you get a few more clues because some people are more sensitive to the future than others. The fifth topic I'll talk about is living, being, and becoming. And this runs into the question of evolution. And for this, we lean a lot on the literature from biology and from ecology. But when we have the idea of living systems, then we get over into this world where we're talking about change, and a lot of it is driven by human action. So Acoff had done a lot of work on trying to create a learning and adaptive system. James Grimm Miller wrote the huge volume Living Systems Theory, which is mostly on the concrete systems, not the abstract systems. Stafford Beer had done work on the viable systems model. Robert Rosen had done work on the modeling relation and anticipatory systems. So these sorts of questions about having evolution in a system come out. And again, they're not just biological systems. They could be things that are human-made. A sixth topic, energy and complexity. How can service systems be sustainable? You end up with this question, and my friend David Hawk talks about perpetual motion machines. Are people trying to design systems that are perpetual motion machines that just continue to exist but really can't? And so we get into the question of sustainability. Some of the leaders in this area, Howard T. Odom, wrote a book called A Prosperous Way Down, which is focused on energy but has deep systems roots, so you end up having to describe whether you would design systems in one way or another. Timothy Allen, that's Timothy F.H. Allen at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, creates the ideas of complex systems versus complicated systems. And so complexity, as we had described before, with hydrogen and oxygen producing water, the water is a different type from hydrogen and oxygen, and so you end up with a distinction there. If you were designing a system, the question is: would you design a complex system that you would put together and have properties, or would you design a complicated system? A complicated system is much more like the internet. In a computer description, you could say that a mainframe computer, as an example, is a complex system. It is actually more efficient to run a mainframe computer because you can utilize the resources and energy in a better way. But a network of personal computers would be a complicated system. The advantage of a complicated system is that if one of the nodes goes down, then the rest of the system may still operate, whereas in a large integrated system, you've got greater efficiency, but you may have problems with sustainability. The seventh topic on form, networks, and power laws: over which scope, scales, and speeds can service systems effectively function? A lot of this work has been done, aside from the power law stuff, which has been done in physics, but the interesting ones I find are around organizations. So Miles and Snow have the idea of cellular form organizations, and can you design organizations as small social networks that are bound together? So again, we get into the idea that it's like the internet, where you would have a cell of people working together, and if you go beyond that cell, then you start running into problems. So some of you may have heard of, oh, I forgot the name of the person, the number, magic number 150, which is about the size of an organization that you could work in, where you could know everybody in the organization. If you get an organization above 150 people, you have to start breaking it down in different ways into groups, because most people can't maintain 150 relationships, even if they are distant relationships. So those of you who are flooded with email can now explain why. And for those of you who have more than 150 Twitter followers, you might consider or following more than 150 people, you might consider reducing your list because it's just too many to manage. Stuart Brand has the idea of shearing layers or pacing layers, and this is in the book How Buildings Learn. And it's also come up in this book, like in The Clock of the Long Now. But the idea is to think about how buildings change. And so he has the idea of structure, which is the load-bearing walls. Inside that, you've got services, which are like the plumbing. You've got the space plan, which is the non-load-bearing walls. And you have stuff, which is all the furniture. So if you're trying to change the services, you're trying to reroute the plumbing in the house, it requires structural change, then all of a sudden you're working on a different layer. So that's a change in form. Perro has the idea of normal accidents, and whether we are designing systems that are too tightly coupled, and should we be designing loosely coupled systems. A loosely coupled system is a complicated system as opposed to being a complex system. And Barabasi has done a lot of work on social networks as of late. Eighth topic, information, communication, and meaning. Now, how do we coordinate service systems? In this area, I've been working a lot on speech act theory and what's called the language action perspective, which comes out of computer science. Flores and Winograd had written a book and various papers on this. We get into phenomenology that Dreyfus has, and we get into conversations in the way that Bella Banathy had done this. And so now we're talking about coordination about between individuals in an organization and how you hold people together. It's more than information, though. It's how you communicate and how do people get meaning from that. As an example, in the language of Flores and Winograd, there are conversations for actions, which are commitments. And so people make commitments to each other, and you make these in cascading sorts of commitments. A commitment to attend this call, as an example, requires that you're actually an NCOSI member, which is a commitment to a relationship. And so if you're not an NCOSI member, you're not supposed to be on this call, so you've now got this network of commitments and relationships and things that happen. They've also got, Flores and Winograd also have the idea about conversations for possibilities. And so we could have, as an example, a discussion where we're talking about the future and things that we could do together, but we're not yet committing to each other. So that sort of clarity comes out in the language action perspective, and in service systems in particular, that where you've got human beings bound to each other primarily by commitments, I found it to be important, an interesting way of looking at them. Ninth topic, coevolution, competition, and variety. How does the service system operate in the context of others? And so as opposed to looking inside the system, we should focus more on outside and thinking about how the system interacts with its environment. In this world, we can talk about Howard Odum and his work on A Prosperous Way Down. Brian Arthur has the idea of increasing returns. And increasing returns creates an interesting bind with the environment. So if more people get on a platform, then you have increasing returns, and you know, how is that different from most other things that happen in the world? They have diminishing returns. Thomas Homer Dixon has a book called The Upside of Down, which is related to some of the work of Odom and of Tim Allen, actually with his co-author Joe Tainter, and the idea of collapse. And the question, in effect, comes, can we actually design a system proactively, or do we have to wait for a system to collapse before we take action? And that's one of the things that we get into with human beings is can we anticipate, which is part of Rosen's work up in number 5, Living, Being, and Becoming. But the idea of collapse, as I've been teaching it, is pretty interesting. When we talk about sustainability, there's so many different definitions of sustainability that now I'm actually trying to get students to think more about collapse. And when I talk about sustainability, I talk about a system that doesn't collapse. Because that's kind of the essential thing. There's a lot of things that can tend to get overloaded on the idea of sustainability because of people's values. But if the system doesn't exist, you're in a different state. And I'd mentioned before, Jerry Ravitz has done work on post-normal science where you can't forecast what the future is going to be. The 10th and last on my list, although my colleague Jennifer Wilby said it should be first on the list, is aesthetics, ethics, and morals. What impact can service systems have on the human condition? When we design a new system, it intervenes in an existing system, and it changes the way that we think about the world. So we end up thinking about the impacts and the maintainability, sustainability, and whether we should or shouldn't design or change the system. Wes Churchman has done a lot of work on this. Peter Checkland's work is actually in this area because when you end up doing soft systems methodology, as an example, you end up bringing in more of the stakeholders in the system. Jane Jacobs in the book Systems of Survival has a really interesting discussion about moral dilemmas and talks about the commercial syndrome and the guardian syndrome and how they need to actually remain distinct because if you blend them, you end up with a mess, you end up with corruption. So this is my view of 10 frames you can think about in systems. There's a paper behind this, and it's available on the Cole-Waldman website. If people want to click through from this, it'll take you actually to that paper. I'm just going to talk briefly, and then we'll have some time for a question and answer. I did part of this section at the bottom as a provocation. Sarah has been helping to organize a session that we have planned for the international workshop where we're going to come in. There'll be some members from the ISSS who will come in, and we've been talking about the way that we have our conversations. And what I proposed is that we have two small groups that have conversations, and one of them will start from the system sciences and try to move towards systems engineering, and the other one is to start from the systems engineering view and move towards system science. And so since John Warfield was active in the International Society for the System Sciences and he published in the ENCOSI journals, I thought it was apt that we should look at what he has to say and talk about the way that he thinks about systems because that's not the way that I think. So from this article, which was in COSI Connect in 2007, he talked about three people that he thought were good examples of people incorporating system science into their practice. But the fundamental thing that he was talking about science was he was talking about a scientific method of discovery is one of those dimensions that remains to be exploited by systems engineers. And he made a differentiation between systems theory and science, which is quite interesting because for him, he was interested in the practice of science, which means that the things that you can experiment and prove that are true over and over again. This might be a bit objectivist for the people that work in social systems and people that work in epistemology that believe in one truth, but I understand where he's coming from, which is you want to be able to make decisions based off some science as opposed to having arbitrary criteria. And so I make the differentiation as an example between systems thinking, which I believe is an art, and system science, which comes from the foundations of biology, from ecology, from physics, from all the other fields. And so the challenge we have in the system sciences is to make things universal. So if I next time you write a definition of systems and you're trying it on a technical system, why don't you see if that same definition will apply in a human system or in ecology, and see if you would change the words in order to do that. John Warfield was focused very much on the idea of performing experiments, getting data, and then changing your practices according to that. So he says that we shouldn't take science lightly, that it's not just calling it a science, that it becomes a science. And he had the idea that the tests are akin to professional standards. I have to admit that I'm getting into a bit of a trouble here now, because I believe in scientific revolutions, and so if we go with Thomas Kuhn and the way that we describe, I describe normal, describe a paradigm shift, is everyone goes out and burns all the textbooks because what you knew was true was no longer true, and those textbooks aren't valid anymore. We have to get to that level of what is the current knowledge, and should we change? How do we evolve that knowledge with it? Warfield had seven component challenges, which are I found interesting, and I'll just touch on briefly. Maybe we'll have some more time in January to discuss these at length. But he talked about second-order thought, which is thoughts about thoughts. The system sciences are pretty strong in this area. You're talking about the reflective practitioner, and the second-order idea comes from cybernetics, where you have to include the observer in the system. So that's worth thinking about. Behavioral pathologies in problematic situations and how do groups and individuals work. This is interesting because Warfield is looking at systems engineering as a social activity, which is good. And the question is what is not working and what could be fixed in those sorts of situations. Discursivity, which is language describing situations and working towards purpose. This aligns a lot with the idea that I was talking about conversation and commitments and getting formal about those sorts of things. Quality control and model development. To me, this is somewhat related to the second-order idea, but you end up with a question about sharing language and where you can actually create standards again. This is much more engineering than it is science. I could see where he might be looking for a scientific critique of them, and it's very deeply rooted in practice. Number five, enabling infrastructure, that you need to have all the things that you need in order to have have the group or the individuals in the group working functionally. So a lot of this could be information system coordination. Metrics of complexity. I would have to dig deeper into Warfield's definitions of what he means by complexity, because they may not be the same definition of complexity that I've described that's coming out of the ecologists. But I can see the idea of metrics, where he's looking for something scientific that you could move forward because you can actually measure something. And then he talks about composite effect, where you take the other six and replicate them, and in effect you create system education and methods for learning. And so this would enable people to move forward together, not have to relearn everything from scratch. And so that's my covering of Warfield, my colleague Gary Metcalf is much more familiar with Warfield, so if we do have a session that goes from the systems engineering to the systems science, I think Gary will be doing that as opposed to me. Just as a note before I close, for people who are interested in discussing systems, we've created a Facebook-like environment called the Systems Community of Inquiry. I had done this initially with the ACOF community around the University of Pennsylvania at syscoi.com. You'll currently see me mostly communicating with students in Finland at the moment. Their assignments in the class were to blog, and so I've been responding to their blogs there. But everyone is welcome to join there, ask questions about systems, we can encourage some more people in the systems community to interchange ideas with you. So that's my talk. I see that we have 13 minutes. If people on the line have questions that they'd like to discuss, I'd welcome them.
This is Sarah. Thank you, David. I think that's interesting. Is this slide with its hyperlinks available to us in some manner?
Yes. So the link at the top, if you read this one, let me go back to the top of the page here. So it's at coevolving.com/maps. You can navigate down to the one that says NCOSI. So if you look at coevolving.com/maps, you'll find it.
Okay, thanks. Any questions, anyone?
Yes, this is Augusto Nieva from California. And is there, what is the best way of, other than checking your paper and doing a survey, to find out what are the projects that are ongoing where one may propose to participate?
Are you asking within ISS or what?
Within ISS.
So the ISSS is a looser group than NCOSI is, and so we actually are trying. It's been developed as a so-called Singerian acquiring system where we're always bringing in new knowledge, and so what you'll find is that the groups change. It's really research at the individual level, and then people networking to get those ideas. So as an example, as a business person, the people I learn most from are actually the ecologists. I'm not learning anything from the business people anymore because I've been studying business for, 30, 40 years.
Right.
So we get into that sort of situation. One of the questions and one of the things that we'll be taking up the international workshop is how, the system science people can help in COSI because the projects that we tend to work on in ISSS are much more research-oriented, much more science-oriented. And I think that within NCOSI, if you have projects that are more concrete, it makes it easier to focus on your projects rather than focusing on our projects. Within the ISSS, we have what are called special integration groups. And the special integration groups are, again, loose groups of people that come together for ideas. So as an example, over the weekend, I got a paper that someone was suggesting they wanted to submit to the conference, and they were writing about business, and they had done living systems theory, and they had done some work on viable systems model, and so that's actually three different groups within the ISSS, and they could present any one of those. And so the question for him would be, so where do you need the most help? If it's a case where you're working on this model and need help from the business people, then you would go to the Systems Applications and Business and Industry, SIG. If you're working on living systems theory and you're looking for people that know James Grimm Miller, you would go to another SIG. If you're interested in the viable systems model and the work of Stafford Beer, you'd end up in another SIG. And so the group is a network. If you are looking for the complex system that puts it all together, this is not it. This is a complicated system.
Thank you.
David, I have a question about the complex and complicated, because within the work I've been doing, usually the differential between complex and complicated is described as complicated grows linearly with size. In other words, there isn't that super linear, nonlinear growth in effort needed to make a system, for example, that you find in a complex system. In other words, it's a diseconomy of scale in a complex system, so that as you get more and more, the number of interfaces grows nonlinearly, and that's the major part of the problem. So we would always, I think we would consider the Internet to be, in a sense, a complex system. And you're saying it's a complicated system. So I'm used to thinking of complicated systems as being, say, in mechanical things where you have, 20,000 parts, it's twice as complicated as 10,000 parts, but a complex system that might be four times or more. Can you talk a little about complicated versus complex and what exactly consists of it?
Okay. So this is actually one of the first ideas I got from the ISSS meeting in 1998 when I first saw Tim Allen present. I see him as actually the world's best ecologist right now because his understanding of this. The definitions that you're using would be, to me, limited to the domain of technical systems or mechanical systems as we describe them, things that you can build that are not living. And so when you get into living systems, you'd have to now start asking the questions about, is your definition still valid in a living system? And so I'm not sure what interfaces mean when we're talking about complexity and complicatedness. Tim Allen makes a big distinction between types and scale. It's possible to differentiate the two that you end up with a different type as opposed to a different scale. This is a very, very complicated discussion. We're not going to have this over the phone. I could give you the references. I can send you the pointers to those ideas. It's something that we could discuss in the systems community of inquiry if you want to do that, and I could try to rope in Tim Allen. This is coming from the idea of that systems are things that cross all types of domains, and so type you could describe in ecologies, you could describe in mechanical systems, you could describe in human systems, in mechanisms, you can describe scale in those sorts of things. And so what I've seen in the definitions that are physically oriented, the ones that are based in physics, they tend to have definitions that don't work in biology.
Asking was, what's the difference between complex and complicated in that situation?
When you talk about, so complexity is a matter of perspective. And so if we go back to the hydrogen, oxygen, water example, if you have water, the property of wetness is not complex. It is part of the properties of water. It's not emergent, and so you end up with the definitions of emergence because you end up with water being a different type from hydrogen, oxygen. So that's a sort of thinking you have to get into. Now, if you're talking about water as a component in a cell, now it's like, okay, now you're at a different level. It's a different type. So water within a human body is there, but you're looking at a different level of system. And so this general idea, this general thread is called hierarchy theory. Hierarchy theory has a semi-bad, it's a bad phrase to use when you're talking about human organizations because they think that hierarchy means organizational hierarchies. And so then you end up having to clean up the language of what do you mean by hierarchy, and you could talk about complicated organizations versus complex organizations. So as an example, in an organization, a complex organization, you could take a company that just gobbles everything up. You know, it buys other companies and makes them internal, and so you know they take over all the payroll systems, they take over. You know, that's a complex system. There's also organizations that buy other companies and then leave them standing alone. And you wonder, well, why did you buy the company and leave it standing alone? And it's because if you buy a company, you change it. But sometimes you don't want to change it, but you do want to own it. And that would be a complicated structure.
All right.
So it applies in many different contexts.
Thank you.
Okay.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I had a question. If you were saying that you needed to check your definitions, if you had a definition of some sort of non-living system, you would have to check it against whether that definition would apply to a living system. If you do, then do you come up with a different definition that applies to both living systems and non-living systems, or you just had different definitions?
Well, now you get into whether the definitions are complex or whether they're complicated. So the idea behind the system sciences is one of isomorphy. So what we would like are definitions, what we prefer is definitions that apply across all types of systems. But you run into the question then about whether you actually need a different definition. So as an example, in a technology versus a human system, if you work on it, you can probably create a definition that crosses that is valid across both, but most people won't appreciate it. And so as an example, when I was talking about in the first of the 10 frames, we talk about value. If you read Norman and Ramirez's work, and they talk about systems, their language means that they think about systems. They think about human systems, and they think about ecologies, and their definitions are actually pretty valid across all domains. They've done that work. Most people don't care. When I look at a lot of the work at organizations, I look at the definitions of organizations that had come from a heritage where they're very strong and they had definitions that would apply across. Some people that don't know systems theory don't use those definitions. Some of the value for using these clear definitions is that systems ideas at the core are across every culture. And so I had an experience where I was working in China. I don't speak Chinese fluently, and I was doing business modeling workshops focused on systems theory. And so I had a Chinese translator going and explaining exactly what it is I was facilitating. And when you're using ideas like function and structure and process, those are ideas that appear in Mandarin, appear in China. It's a universal sort of thing. It's had, you know, thousands of years to work out the definitions. It's not like tweeting that has a very short definition, right, a short history. So the use, it comes down to practicality. For a systems scientist, and this may be where systems engineering and systems science may diverge, is if you were engineering a human system as opposed to engineering a mechanical system, would you use the same language or different language? If you used a language that bridged both of them, then you could actually come into a human organization redesign, as an example, and use that same language. If you were not doing something that general, you might have problems when you're crossing domains and you end up having to define things, you end up with that semantic sort of definitional issue. Does that answer the question?
That's great. Thank you.
I would like to ask a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
David, you presented nicely the social system side of ISSS, and ISSS traditionally and historically had a lot of sciences in it besides ecology.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask you if at the international workshop you're going to have representation from that science side, more like the NEXI organization, but there still are remaining people in ISSS who have that orientation, because that might be as close to systems engineering, which has both a social systems and a natural systems side to its enterprise.
This sounds like Glenn Troncalli. So the meeting at the international workshop in January is the first meeting. So we had a meeting at the international symposium where it was just getting to know each other, and we still haven't formally struck the relationship agreement, although it's really nothing to say between two organizations. So the ISSS is coming into NCOSI to find out what NCOSI wants, in effect. And I don't know if the ISSS members know what we want from the NCOSI relationship either. So I don't see this as a short-term project-oriented sort of thing. I see it as a long-term relationship that we're trying to define. And so for the international workshop in January, we're looking at a relatively small group. When we get more formalized, then we would bring in the larger group. So, again, who's in that group? It varies according to interests, and it depends on where we want to go. Any other questions?
Hi, this is Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes. Mike?
Okay. Just a quick question: that the difference, the complicated versus the complex, does that have to do with the the number of patterns that exist that can be repeated? I was thinking about your example of the business that buys other businesses and incorporates them versus buys them and lets them run. Does that have to do with the ability to define and use patterns within your design?
I'll lean on Tim Allen's work a lot for that, for the definitions, but it's fundamentally based in energy.
Okay.
And he has an idea of what's called high-gain systems and low-gain systems.
Right.
And all this is, again, relative to each other, but it's associated with energy, which could be a pattern, but it isn't the one I think it comes from. If there are no other questions, I see that we're a few minutes over 12, and we should close out. Sarah?
Thank you, David. This is Sarah again, and I'd like to say that I hope we get this recording that, you know, it worked once we tried it and it did not. And if we do, then I'm going to do what I can to figure out how to put it up on the ECOSI Complex Systems Connect site. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll end the call, and I'll push the stop button.